Welcome to the Retzel Health Law Hotspot. Health Law Hotspot is a podcast for physicians and health professionals that covers the legal issues and trends that affect the healthcare industry.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Health Law Hotspot. I'm Erica Adler, shareholder and health group leader at Retzel and Andrus. And today I'm joined by my colleague, Christina Kuda, who is also part, a very important part of our healthcare practice. And as always, Christina and I like to cover topics that are important to our clients and address some of the questions that come to us every day. So today we're going to be talking about negotiating an employment agreement for a physician or even for a dentist. What are some of the basic terms that you should be looking for when you review the contract? What are some of the concerns that you want to think about? And I guess, what are some of the red flags as well? Hopefully we can share our experience with you and maybe some examples of some of the things that we've seen as well. So thanks for coming on today, Christina.
Happy to be here.
So let's start with a basic employment agreement. You know, typically most of them, some are long, some are short, they all kind of look different, but essentially they always, you know, contain pretty much the same terms. And one of the first things I like to do when I look at an employment agreement is to be able to talk to the doctor or the dentist and say, hey, what is life going to be like when you're working there? And that for me comes down to call, location, and schedule. So I like to start with those three things. And very often I find that whatever has been discussed is not usually contained in the actual document. Do you have that experience as well?
I do. I'll have physicians tell me all the time that they heard from the recruiter for their employer or the employer directly that call, for example, is going to be shared equally amongst all the group physicians. But then I'll see an employment agreement that doesn't say calls shared equally. I think sometimes physicians will assume that that's part of the document since that's what they were told. But if it's not written down in the agreement and you sign that agreement, you have to live with what it says. So it's always important if you've got some emails or you've had discussions with your employer about certain terms or conditions that will be in the document, that you make sure they're in the document in the way that you understood them to be, because it's very difficult legally to look back at those old emails and those old discussions and try to make a legal claim that that was the intent when something is different in the actual written document.
Absolutely. So let's start with schedule. So schedule is one of those things where I kind of feel like my doctors will tell me, oh, I'm working a 4-day work week. I don't ever have to work weekends or evenings. And, or they say something like, I'm allowed to make my own schedule. And most contracts I look at will say, you'll work when the employer tells you to work. So there's obviously a direct conflict. I like to resolve that by either saying, can we get what you spoke about into the document? And a lot of times employers will say, you know, we don't like to put that in our agreement, but don't worry, we would never do that to you or something like that. We're going to keep our word. And so sometimes I'll try and say, well, can we at least get that the schedule be mutually agreed upon? Because then you can't be forced to do something. And, you know, this is one of the first things that we kind of fight with the employer about when we're doing the contract. And I will mention that during COVID, this became really important. There were a shortage of providers and doctors were really asked to work hours or schedules that they hadn't previously been asked to. And although many of them were like, of course, you know, we'll help in any way. But in general, having that control over your schedule is really important, particularly doctors that may have other commitments. Maybe they have children at home or, you know, they work a few days a week and their spouse works the other days of the week. You know, there's lots of different arrangements out there. So for me, schedule is really important. Do you find that this is something that you battle with employers over?
For sure. Like you said, employers like to leave things a little bit more open-ended or general. Whereas when I'm counseling providers, I like to tell them, look, if your expectation is you're going to work Monday from Friday, you know, from 9 to 5, and that's really what you expect of this employment, you really should have that in the agreement. Because even just having mutually agreed doesn't ensure you're going to get the Monday through Friday 9 to 5. Right. I also find this is really important when you're talking about non-clinical services. A lot of employment agreements, particularly when they're with a hospital or medical center, will say a physician has to do some amount of administrative or non-clinical work, but it won't have a schedule. It won't have a maximum number of hours per month or per year. So, and a lot of times the hospital say, oh, well, it's nothing that will overtax you. But the agreement says you're going to do administrative work as the hospital requires you to do. So I always like to at least have a maximum amount per month or per year, just to ensure that it won't be a situation where the physician's having to spend so much time doing administrative work that they're not able to fulfill without hardship all their clinical obligations as well.
Right, I agree. Now we're on both sides because we represent a lot of employers as well. So I completely understand them wanting the flexibility. I would say that, you know, if you want to be competitive, you really can't just go with the language in many cases that say you work when you're told to work. I think, you know, especially after COVID, everybody's very lifestyle oriented. There's a shortage of doctors out there, dentists out there, and, you know, they can kind of choose in many cases the contract that speaks to them. So I think some flexibility on this is really what we can expect and hope to see going forward.
Sure. And I found that most physicians are generally somewhat flexible as well. If you can get a base schedule, a base number of hours or base days down, they understand circumstances may occur where they have to work more than that for some reason. And they went into a profession knowing that it's a lot of on-demand services. But just having a base expectation is so important between the parties and to try to prevent conflict in the future.
Right. And, you know, on a couple of points related to this, you mentioned call already. And I want to say mutual agreement on call is fantastic. Typically, equal call is great, too. The problem with that is that you may start off with a certain number of doctors and then that shrinks down. So it's equal, but it's still way more than you wanted. So I'm not always loving equal, but it depends. In some practices, call is not very heavy. Right. Sure. In others, it can be very heavy. In certain specialties where call is really substantial and you went to the employer and the employer said, you know, call is no more than, you know, 1 in 4. So every fourth weekend, every fourth night, every, you know, whatever it may be. And you absolutely do not want a job where you're going to be working more than that. Then I think it's really important that you fight for that cap on call. A lot of times the employer will come back and say, oh, but, you know, we'll pay you if you do more than that. But for many doctors, it's not about money. It's really about their time. They don't want to work harder than that. Sure. And so I kind of want to mention that, too, because it does fit into scheduling as well. And it's something that is, you know, often a battle in a contract.
And I just, to that point, I just worked on an agreement with a physician who was going to be employed by hospital, and the call obligation said equal coverage. Well, currently there's 4 physicians in this practice group that would share the call, but we managed to get a revision to the agreement that said that if the number of physicians in this practice group goes down to less than 3, then the hospital is obligated to either get a locums to replace a physician or make sure they hire a physician or have another group help with coverage. So they would never be more than 1 in 3, regardless of how many people are actually in the practice group.
Excellent. And that comes up really often. Like I said, not all groups have call concerns, but where that does exist, that is an important point. Now, one other thing I kind of want to mention related to this topic is also most doctors have an idea of what their job is going to entail. And they're outpatient doctor, or they do inpatient work, or maybe some combination. And I'm only mentioning this because I have COVID on my mind, even though we're kind of coming out of it. But during COVID, it became really important that the duties of a physician were described. Now, typically, say you'll provide services within your specialty, and it doesn't always go into more detail. Sometimes it does. But what we saw during COVID was doctors who are always outpatient were being asked to do inpatient work because there was such a shortage. And a lot of doctors have been like, you know, I haven't done any inpatient work in 10 years, mm-hmm. you know, and they felt really uncomfortable. Or, and this will lead to our next topic, they were sent to locations. You know, they put up a lot of COVID centers, you know, amidst the pandemic, and they were sent to work at a center that obviously wasn't the office they were expecting to work at, wasn't the type of services they were really hired to do, but it all came down to COVID. So again, it's what are the services you're providing? Are they spelled out? Are they clear? Are changes requiring mutual agreement? You know, and then location, which is the next topic I want to talk about. Where can you be sent? And most contracts will say, you know, either very clearly, this is your office, or more common, this is your office, but we can also send you anywhere else we want to send you.
And that could be, you know, get a mile restriction or something if you don't want to drive 50 miles, or, you know, we live and work in Chicago, so 10 miles could be a really long commute depending on where you're going. So, right, you know, you really want to get some kind of restriction on that. So there's limits.
Right.
And, you know, I just recently had a situation when you're talking about this, the service issue and knowing what you're doing. I work with a physician who is an oncology surgeon who has not done any general surgery for 10 years. He signed an agreement without getting legal advice or really understanding what it said. And it actually had him required to do oncology surgical call and general surgical call. He was not comfortable with general surgery, so he had his privileges changed. And the hospital, that was a breach of the agreement, and the hospital terminated the contract because of that.
That's not uncommon. I see that sometimes with other types of surgeons who are required to take general surgical call as well. That's a really good point, and you want to be careful. So all of these things are really about making sure that whatever you've discussed, whatever you believe your job entails, is really spelled out in that document. Now, between you and me, sometimes we'll talk to a doctor and they never even mention these particular concerns or things. We can only kind of help our clients as much as they tell us, you know, so we ask questions. Is there anything about call? What did you talk about with them? Is there anything, any concerns you have, you know? But if they're like, no, it seems fair, everybody's happy there, that's a very common response, sure, I get, then we wouldn't be able to help. So it's also important to really think about worst case scenario. And, you know, you and I are like the doomsdayer of contracts, because we're always trying to think about what is the worst thing that could happen and writing the contract for that purpose.
Sure. And that's particularly true, I find, and I think you'll agree, with respect to new physicians coming out of fellowship or residency. Sometimes they feel they don't have a great bargaining position. They just want that new job. They have student loans to pay off. They want to buy a house. They have a lot of things they have to do, and they need employment. They want to start their career. And I understand that. Even in our profession, you know, we can kind of understand why your first job's out. You just want to get that first job. The problem is you can really get yourself stuck in a bad situation that you didn't intend to be in, that's not going to optimize your clinical skills or optimize the growth of your practice based on what that contract says. You always wanted to, I always ask providers, dentists, physicians, what did you talk about? And is there anything that I've told you today when I reviewed your contract that is different than what you talked about, or I didn't mention it and you think it should be mentioned? Just to be clear that their expectation meets the document as much as possible.
I absolutely agree. Now, one of the key things, though, that I always tell my doctors, because, you know, when you're reviewing a contract, you know, your bargaining power, as you mentioned, is important. But a lot of times, big organizations, they just have a lot of doctors and a lot of people have already signed the contract. You may not be able to get changes to your document. In fact, it's most likely that you're not going to get changes to your document. Sure. And then our goal really is to just have you understand there shouldn't be any surprises. So exactly. What happens if you're signing a contract and they won't put in what they told you about the call, the schedule, the location, but you still want the job? My next comment to my clients will always be, make sure you know your exit strategy, because they're saying, hey, trust us. We're never going to send you somewhere you don't want to go. We're not going to make you work hours you don't want to work. But if it does happen, you need to know how you can leave. So I kind of want to talk now about what that exit strategy is. And typically for me, that comes down to notice. And then the exit strategy components, which are typically non-compete, malpractice, obviously, and then any kind of financial obligations that may be tied to termination, okay? So first of all, let's talk about termination. And I'll just start off by saying that every physician contract typically has reasons that a physician or dentist can be terminated for cause. It typically, which can include automatic termination, things like death or loss of license, as well as more discretionary things. And it also always typically includes the ability to terminate without cause, okay? And that means you, on average, about 90 days notice, but it could be shorter, it could be longer. And I think that's important because, you know, a lot of people are like, oh my God, they could terminate me without cause. And to me, that's a pretty common provision. So if somebody's telling you otherwise, it's simply, you know, not true. No, those are really important. And a lot of times, you know, a provider will come to me and say, oh, I have a 3-year contract, I have a 5-year contract, but then it can be terminated without cause at any time on 90 days notice. And I always say, well, you kind of, I know it says that, but really your contract is only as long as your notice provision.
Sure, no obligations.
That can be,
made, yeah.
a little shocking to them. What do you mean? Sure. It's only a 90-day contract. And then, you know, maybe they don't want either party to be able to terminate for a year or 2 years, but there's pros and cons, because if you ask the provider, or sorry, the employer, not to be able to terminate you, they'll be looking for the same commitment. And then if you want to leave, you're locked in. So you have to kind of look at all the variables.
Sure. And I've noticed too, in contracts, I mean, good contracts will be mutual. So if one party can terminate, you know, in 90 days without notice, the other party can. I've seen contracts, particularly a few recently, where the employer can terminate for a host of for cause reasons, including a material breach if it's not cured within a certain time period, but the actual employee can only terminate without cause on like a 90 or 120 day notice period. And that's a red flag to me. If your employer isn't paying you or isn't living up to the contract, doing things that breach the contract, and that does happen, you need to be able to have a way to get out of that contract and not simply have to give 120 days notice and sit there and continue taking the breaches for the next, you know, 3 or 4 months. So those are things important to keep in mind for sure when you're looking at the termination.
And another thing that you and I are seeing quite often now is it'll require notice by either party to terminate, but then the employer is giving themselves the right to say, oh, but if the doctor gives us the notice, we can accelerate that and terminate immediately. And woo, you know, that's scary. That means that if you give proper notice as a provider, you could just be terminated immediately. And we don't want that. What I usually do in that situation is say, okay, if you don't want me to come in, that's great, but you still have to pay me and give me my benefits for the notice period. That is a real red flag. I usually will advise my providers not to sign a contract with language like that in it unless it's fixed. And to me, that's very scary language, because you have no job security at that point.
For sure. And I've seen it too, where even if it says we'll pay you your compensation, let's say you have a base compensation for like that 3 month period rather than just keep you on with during the notice period, but it'll say, but basically if we accelerate that and tell you not to come in, then any bonus you would have earned, I mean, you could give notice in November and pretty much earned almost a full year's bonus. And they'll say, but we'll pay your basic comp, but you're not getting a dime of bonus. And those are the kinds of things you want to watch. What are the other financial benefits of this agreement that may go away if the employer can unilaterally decide to accelerate that notice provision that really could cost you money?
Right. And, you know, since you're talking about financial component, if you receive a signing bonus or something like that, you also, if you go to leave, depending on the period of time, may owe back some or all of that signing bonus or relocation allowance or some amount. And so the reason that termination occurred is something that I always kind of want to argue, like, look, if you let me go for no reason, employer, I shouldn't have to pay it back.
Yeah, if you breach,
I should have to pay it back.
Exactly. Those should be forgiven. And right. I don't know if you want to talk about this now, but I know we'll probably talk about restrictive covenants today. And essentially that's the same thing for restrictive covenants. I always try to say, look, you're probably not going to get an agreement that doesn't have some sort of restrictive covenant. But if you, employer, terminate me for no reason, or I terminate for breach because you've done something wrong and you haven't cured it, I don't think it's fair to be tied to those restrictive covenant provisions. Oftentimes employers, because they like to keep things very uniform with all their employees, don't agree to make those kinds of changes, but I think it's always worth asking, because that seems to be the most reasonable and fair approach in those termination circumstances.
Right. I think that's a great point. And so what I want to also emphasize is these same concepts apply to other things in your contract, including who's going to be responsible for paying for a malpractice tail, which we're going to talk about. And in addition to the ones that we've talked about, which are your let go without cause or the employer breaches, every contract has different provision. So you really have to be careful. If the employer has a right to non-renew, what happens with each of these components? If the contract just expires, what happens? What happens if they're able to terminate the contract because of a change in the law or one of those force majeure provisions? How does that impact the tail, the non-compete, the repayment bonus obligation? So you really want to look at all the termination related provisions and how they impact that exit strategy. So I think that's really important. And we're not even thinking, sometimes I even put in, you know, failure to offer partnership could be a trigger. So if you decide to leave, you don't have a non-compete, you don't have a tail. Now, employers may or may not agree to some of these, but you never know unless you ask, right? When we represent employers, you know, most of them, I would say, are pretty reasonable and they'll consider it. And you're right, you know, how many people have signed the same contract plays a role in whether they feel they can make changes like that. So, but a lot of them can be very fair. So since you mentioned the non-competes, and I don't want to go into a lot of detail because it is a state-related topic, and we have done previous podcasts on non-competes, but do want to mention it as it relates to location. Because you and I kind of talked about how, you know, specifying the location or agreeing that it's mutually agreeable location or something is so important. In the non-compete, it typically is tied to your location. And if you could be sent anywhere, what is the location to which the non-compete applies? And a lot of times they'll just say, anywhere you worked, right?
Does that mean if you worked, mean if you worked one day, like they sent you to one office one day? It could if it's not spelled out appropriately.
Right. What if they're sending you to a different office every day? You know, and that's your schedule now. Does it apply to five locations? Like, you know, so that's why I usually try and do something like places that you regularly worked, or even better, at one place that you agreed you were going to work at. Yeah. Right?
Get an address, an actual address. This is the place, and it's, you know, not within 10 miles of this particular place.
Right. Absolutely. So I think location and non-compete are super important. And if you want to hear more about non-competes, you can listen to our podcast on that, because we really go into a lot of detail on that issue in Illinois and other states that have non-compete laws. All right. So let's talk about malpractice insurance. So why don't you describe the issues with that?
So with malpractice insurance, one thing you want to be clear from the outset is who's paying for the policy. Generally, if you're an employee, the employer pays for the policy, but I have seen a few instances where that wasn't necessarily the case. But you want to make sure that your employer, if you're the, you know, the provider, is paying for the policy. You also want to make sure what type of policy you're getting. Are you getting, you know, a claims made policy? Are you getting an occurrence policy? Those cover different circumstances and also can inform whether or not you'll need a tail. You'll want to see what the minimum coverage limits are and the maximum coverage limits. I've had circumstances where contracts will say that you're getting a professional liability insurance in such amount as the practice thinks is reasonable. Well, what is that? You know, we typically see as common, you know, a million per claim, 3 million in the annual aggregate, but maybe that practice doesn't see that as reasonable. Maybe they see it as less. That might not be great coverage for you. Right. Who's the carrier? I mean, only certain people, certain businesses, pardon me, can actually write malpractice policies in given states pursuant to state laws. But who is the carrier? Is this a reputable carrier? Is this a carrier that's known for, you know, not supporting their providers as well as they should when there is a claim? So those are all things you want to keep in mind. And you also want to keep in mind, again, if you will need tail coverage, if it's going to only cover, if your policy only covers claims that are made during the policy period, a claim could be made after you leave this employment and you have no coverage for that. So is the provider practice going to pay for the tail? And what's going to be required if you have to pay for the tail? Will they accept tail insurance? Will they accept a prior endorsement if your new employer will provide that to you with a different insurance carrier? There's a lot of different things to consider with your professional liability insurance. And it, you know, it just seems like boilerplate language that you just kind of blow through and say, okay, I have insurance. But just knowing you have insurance is not enough.
I would say that's one of the biggest issues that people ask me about. Do I have to buy a tail? Are there other options? And you're right, you know, can the employer buy what's, the new employer buy what's commonly called a nose? Another option is just to be able to take the policy with you and to keep paying the premiums on it. Mm-hmm. I like to fight for that. I mean, obviously with large hospitals or whatever, you know, they don't agree to that. But it really depends on the kind of contract. You know, in dental contracts, most dentists have occurrence policies and will take it with them from one practice to another. So you really want to just make sure you're understanding that. And as we previously talked about, depending on the reason for circumstance, who should be paying for that tail? That's something definitely to fight for. All right. So we talked about your exit strategy in terms of the amount of notice. We talked about whether the non-compete is going to apply. We talked about the tail obligation, if any, and we talked about financial obligations that might exist in terms of whether you have to pay back money or not. And I think these are all just understanding, okay, they promised me this was gonna be my schedule. They promised me they weren't gonna send me to other locations. They're not keeping their word. Do I know how to leave if I'm not happy? And you should be able to run through all of those components we just talked about and know how to get out of that contract. So if it's a 90-day notice, you don't have to worry about a tail, and it's a non-compete that you can live with, I would consider that a win-win, right? And so that's kind of how you should think about your contract. What story does it really tell about your employment? Now, one other thing that we really, you know, probably don't have time to go into too much detail would be the compensation package in a contract, right? And every contract I look at is different. So there's really no one way to talk about it, right? There's base salaries, there's percentage of collections, right? RVU packages. You know, I mean, those are kind of the basic ones I see. What else do you see?
I mean, that's typically what I see as well. You know, sometimes they'll have a lot of different formulas that relate to different things, maybe like relate if you're a surgeon, for example, one formula relates to the surgical cases, one relates to, you know, if you're doing sort of outpatient clinic work, how that might relate, how you might get paid for administrative services, you might get paid for call, bonus opportunities, you have to meet a certain threshold from your billings to get a bonus, or a certain RVU threshold. Also, is a bonus tied to how your whole group does? If you're sort of lumped into like a pod, let's say at a hospital, for example, do you only get a percentage of a bonus that everyone in that pod gets, and that pod collectively has to meet certain qualifications in order to obtain a bonus? I mean, compensation formulas, like you said, vary, and some are fairly straightforward, and some I feel like sometimes you have to be a mathematician to figure out exactly all the, you know, all the ins and outs. One of the things I have noticed is whenever I see formula compensation, a lot of times it doesn't really tell you what the exact compensation will be. You don't really know. I can tell you what the formula is, but I can't tell you what money you might get because we don't have the real dollars and cents. So I always recommend talking to the person you're working with at the practice to say, how did the doctors do last year on this formula? What were the average salaries? What might I expect, to get sort of a better idea of what your compensation might be on a particular formula? Also understanding a lot of agreements will start with a base salary and that's it. And then in year three, move to this formula. You need to understand what that formula looks like and how that might change. You may no longer have a promise of a base amount. Usually people do better, but it's not required generally, or in the agreement doesn't usually say that there's going to be some kind of floor. So you need to really pay attention to how compensation can change over the years.
Right. I absolutely agree. And we could probably do a separate podcast just on compensation. But what I also just want to mention here is make sure that your contract, in addition to spelling out compensation, if it's a formula, gives you the right to look at data from time to time, like collections or whatever. If you were promised certain benefits, fringe benefits, make sure they're in there. If you were promised your own mid-level, a scribe, make sure it's in there. If they said they were taking care of certain expenses, you know, make sure it's in there. So don't rely on anything you're told. Try and get all these promises in writing. A lot of them are compensation or financially related, but you know, you can't, just as Christina said earlier, those emails they sent you, they go away. And you know, what I want to kind of sum up this whole conversation with is every single contract, for the most part, has a provision in there, and it might have a different title, but usually it's something like complete agreement or entire agreement. And what this says is exactly what we've been saying all along. This is it. This and the attached exhibits are your entire arrangement. Anything we've talked about orally, your interviews, your side letters, your emails, any discussions are not binding among the parties. And so whatever it is that you may have discussed or what you may have expected, it really needs to be in there so that we can help you when you know, the other party doesn't honor their obligations, if that should happen. And I don't want to kind of put it out there that people don't keep their word. I will say the majority of contracts work out just fine. The employer promises something and they see it through. I really don't see gross mistreatment of, you know, employees. I don't see employers making promises they don't keep. That's just really not the case. But it does happen. And you don't want it to happen to you and not have a contract that we could help you with.
For sure. And to piggyback on that with the integration clause that you mentioned, one of the other things I want to point out that's very important is if your employment agreement references a policy that you're bound by, make sure you get a copy of that policy and review it. I reviewed an employment agreement a couple months ago that said absolutely nothing about any of the terms. It said everything was pursuant to a different policy and the employer didn't provide those policies. So I had to call the provider, the physician, and say, I can't tell you anything until I see these 15 policies. Right. So if it says your vacation is subject to our vacation policy, you need to know what that says, because otherwise I can't tell you what your vacation is. Mm. And note that those policies generally can be unilaterally amended from time to time. So, and right. So what it says on the day you sign, you get 4 weeks vacation. They can decide a year from now, we don't like that. We want 3 weeks. And because you're subject to that policy, they can do that. So it's right. really important to not overlook reference documents in an employment agreement.
I think that's a great point. And they're not negotiable. So, you know, I find that's a growing trend where they put as little as they can in the document and wait. And that's more for like hospitals and bigger yeah. employers. But as a side note, before we wrap up, academic contracts are somewhat frustrating as well, because you get like this letter that doesn't really say anything. And it mostly just directs you to the faculty policies or other policies. And it doesn't really tell you much. It's very hard to even have a conversation about some of the basic terms we've covered today with somebody who's taking a faculty job, because they don't give you any information. So, you know, sometimes it can be very hard to guide physicians who are signing those contracts, because so much of it is verbal and discussion, and it can be really tough.
Sure. And B, you know, I always go into every contract with the provider with good spirit and good intent. This is going to be a great job for you, and we're going to help you make this a great contract. But I have seen instances, few, but some, where an employer won't give those policies or say, well, I'll show them to you after you sign the contract. Oh, red sure. flag. That's a really big red right. flag. If someone
will or they're too big, you know, when you need them, you'll have them or something like that. Yeah. I mean, I unfortunately sometimes it's really big hospital systems that will do that. And I hate to say something's a red flag, but you're right. It absolutely gives me pause. And of course, it's always the doctor's decision. There have been a couple cases where I will say something like, I wouldn't sign this yeah. if I were you. And you know, oh, just one more thing before we go, we could talk about this forever, our probationary period. So I don't know, I find them offensive because here you are a doctor, you're licensed, it takes 90 to 120 days to get credentialed or your dentist, and it takes time to get all ready to start working somewhere. And they have this provision that says, oh, during the first 90 days, we're like trying you out. And if we don't like you, we could terminate you immediately. Like, what kind of job security is that? Why would you take that job over a different job where if they don't like you, at least they'll give you the 90 days notice so you could find something yeah. else? Like, to me, I have to say, to me, that is like a huge red flag.
Yeah, and it you're right, particularly in the type of professions that we're most often working with, it is somewhat insulting. And, you know, you it's like we're committing to you, but we're making absolutely no commitment at all whatsoever. And, you know, you also have to wonder, is the employer going to do everything they can to help advance you during those 90 days probationary period? Or is it going to be you're going to sink or swim and not have much help from your employer? So those are frustrating. And luckily we don't see them that much, but when they do happen, that's something to consider about your future employer.
Absolutely. All right. So we are out of time. We have to go. This has been great, though. I hope everybody listening has found it helpful. And we are always open to you calling us or emailing us if you have questions. If there's some subsection of this podcast you wish we would go into in more detail, we can definitely do it. I mean, as I'm wrapping up, I'm thinking of 10 or 20 things I wish that we had talked about. So we could probably do a whole part two on this if we want. Maybe we will. But again, I'm Erica Adler, and this is Christina Kuda, and we're part of the Health Law Group at Retzel and Andrus. So thank you for joining us, and you can check out our other podcasts at the Health Law Hotspot. You can also go to ralaw.com to find out more about our practice, and we'll see you next time.
The Retzel Health Law Hotspot is made available by the firm and its attorneys for educational purposes and to provide general information, not to provide specific legal advice. Use of the Retzel Health Law Hotspot does not create an attorney-client relationship between you and the firm or any of its attorneys. The Retzel Health Law Hotspot should not be used as a substitute for competent legal advice, and you should contact an attorney in your state about any legal needs or questions you may have.